welcome everybody to our final episode of season 5 here with the Armchair Dragoons. This is Mentioned in Dispatches, and it's not Mentioned in Dispatches without one of our regulars, Jim, Mr. Cyrano himself. Jim, how are you tonight?
Hey, I'm doing well. Good evening to you.
Hey, and keeping the grand Jim tradition alive, this is going to be yet another excessively long podcast, isn't it?
I'm going to do my very best to make sure everyone else stays about past their bedtime.
Yes. Well, and we have our buddy, our super fan on Twitter, Fred Keisha. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing his name. Sorry, Fred. I know I'm mispronouncing your name. Fred's dog walks are the length of our podcast. So on days when you are here with our podcast, the dog gets a really good walk. And on days when you are not, like when we have Pascal staying up past his bedtime over in Europe, they are far shorter walks for this. I think the dogs are going to get a good hike out of today.
You can count on it.
Also returning to the podcast, Mr. James Sterrett. Mr. James, how are you?
Hello, I'm doing okay.
And, have you guys hit subarctic where you are yet?
Oh, no.
Not yet?
No.
I mean, it's coming, but I just...
it might come this year. Keep in mind, my wife's from Canada. She doesn't think Kansas has winter.
Yes, yes. Well, your wife does have a different perspective. So we have a pair of podcast rookies with us tonight. First times on Mention and Dispatches for both of them. Marshall, you're down in Southern California, right?
Yes, I am. And the best part about winter is watching it on TV.
Yeah, yeah. So you go out in December and clear 4 inches of sunshine off your car, right?
Yep, short sleeves. Yep.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. And then also podcast rookie, although no stranger to the Dragoons, regular with us at Origins for several years now, Mr. Scott joining us from Cincinnati, right, Scott?
Yes, how are you?
From the from up against the river there. What's the nickname on Cincinnati?
The nickname?
Yeah.
Queen City?
You see, I was thinking Queen City, but that's what people here in North Carolina call Charlotte also, because it's actually named after a named Charlotte. So I wasn't sure. So, okay. So Cincinnati thinks they are also the Queen City.
Well, we like to pretend a lot of things.
There you go. So this rather large group was assembled for a very specific reason for tonight. And that is, if you're going to talk about a Kriegsspiel that lasted 2.5 years, spanned multiple websites, multiple time zones, looked multiple grades for the children of the parents participating in this, then we needed a large cast and an extended period of time to talk about it. And so this Kriegsspiel was organized by Jim. This is the second or third of the big online Kriegsspiel.
Number two.
And uses the forum to sort of keep people updated as to kind of when the turns are turning over. But it's all direct comms between him and the players as to what's going on. While all this is going on, Jim is also shooting archival video footage that we've got linked here to the podcast and shared on our site that kind of tells the story of the battle as it's gone along. And Jim, at this point, it's probably best for you to take over setting the stage for what this big battle was.
Sure. If nobody's going to be able to see the video here, but I'm sitting in front of my background that I always have of Von Reisfitz. I've loved the Kriegsspiel since first I discovered it a whole lot of years ago. I wanted to bring it online because it occurred to me that our circumstances to play it face to face, while they're always to be sought and cherished when you get them, are sufficiently rare that I wanted to try to find another way to do it. So I started puzzling through ways that it could be done via email. I realized, however, that you still need, as all good Kriegsspiels do, a normative map. So we did all that. We created all those things. But through the websites, we've been able to tell two really cool stories. We used the system that was created by Dr. Didier Rouy, who still is, though very French named, is out in California now, enjoying the sunny weather, of Pratzen Editions. He's actually designed not just the Flight of the Eagles system, but also a number of very well-regarded Napoleonic tactical games, Grand Tactical, actually. And so he's done a lot of this game development, but he developed the system. I fell in love with it. It was exactly what I wanted for an operational Kriegsspiel. The first one we did was the Jena-Auerstedt campaign in October of 1806. Had a great success, wound up a French win. And this time we decided to do my more recent interest in the early phases, the first half of the 1809 campaign in Bavaria. And so we assembled the armies of the Archduke Charles
and the armies of initially a dispersed contingent of French people, and eventually Napoleon Bonaparte, who arrives a bit later on the battlefield and gathered the different forces together, gave them the maps, gave them the troops, gave them an outline of the rules, and assembled. And I guess the last thing I'll note before I flip it back to you, Brandt, is that once again, and it's one of the really cool things about doing Kriegsspiels like this, is we get a really neat mix of old hands, like Marshall himself, and of course, James, but we also get new people, like Scott, people who've heard about it, maybe are interested in it, and want to have a first experience of it. So it was pretty cool to be able to bring them all together in one place and do this. As you say, I shot the first video of this. My mind tells me it was in late September of 2018, and we finally did manage to put a period on it just a little while ago. So it was neat to be able to take it. 6 weeks
ago as we're recording.
Yeah, so it was kind of neat to be able to take it through that whole process.
Yeah, so September of 2018 would have been right after the Dragoons had opened the doors. Marshall obviously has some experience with Kriegsspiel. Marshall, what's the full name of the organization that you've got down there in SoCal?
It's the Southern California Kriegsspiel Society.
Gotcha. And it's plague conditions aside, obviously, but I mean, you guys tend to get together for regular in-person Kriegsspiel events, not necessarily just online stuff, correct?
Yeah, we usually get together 3 times a year for face-to-face games. We'll have about 15 to 20 people, more or less, give or take. We run it at the Strategicon conventions, which are held 3 times a year. On the long weekends, President's Day, Labor Day, Memorial Day. It's at the LAX Hilton currently. Of course, right now for the past year, because like you say, the plague conditions, we've sort of been on hiatus, which has driven me to try to find other ways to run these games. And we've been doing some stuff online with great success. But yeah, that's what we do. We also have a Facebook group, which anybody is welcome to join. Just search Southern California Kriegsspiel Society on Facebook. And we'll let you in.
And we'll link it to the podcast. We're not going to make people go hunting around Google when we can just post a hyperlink with the episode there. That one's easy enough. We'll throw enough traffic your way. So was this your first online Kriegsspiel then? The participating in this one, or had you done some others before you jumped in with Jim here?
I think this may have been my first one. I've actually run some by email since then, or in the middle of all this. I've run about 2 of them by email, one which is actually ongoing. But yes, I think this is the first one that I can recall that I participated in play by email.
Cool. Scott, you joined us for some Kriegsspiels at Origins, correct?
Yeah, it was only like was it 2 hours, maybe 3? So it was much, much shorter than this.
Certainly not 2.5 years at Origins. So, yeah, totally understandable. But I was pretty sure you had, you know, that we had video footage of you having popped into at least one of the Kriegsspiels at Origins. But this was your first big online one, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, James, I know this is not your first online Kriegsspiel. So, because you had played in Jim's first one, correct? Oh, James is talking to us with the mute button on. We're going to find him a Kopeck.
Sorry.
I'm not editing out you leaving the mute button.
This was not my first online Kriegsspiel. I was in the first one that Jim ran as well.
Yeah, I was pretty sure you were there. So, Scott, you've played in a face-to-face one for real, and you've played in one online now. Obviously, the face-to-face one, the in-person one at Origins, much shorter, probably a little less intense, but a lot less time to ponder sort of what you're doing as the action is flowing there. What did you think of the Kriegsspiels as a whole, and kind of what got you interested in doing any kind of Kriegsspiel, and then what made you jump in with this online?
Well, initially at Origins, when I jumped into it, I had no idea what it was. And I can't remember if it was you or Jim had mentioned it to me. And I thought, well, that sounds interesting. I'll try that out, and had some free time that day and jumped into it and had a good time. And then afterwards, one of you told me about the online one that was getting ready to start up, that there was still room in it. Went up and I believe I talked to Jim about it, got emails exchanged and jumped into it. Ultimately, I have to say, I like the online one better. And I don't know if it was just the setting of Origins being so, you know, just you've got the chaos going around you, the noise and all the people wandering up trying to see what you're doing and whatnot, or if it was just that, you know, the online one, the downtime, I'm living the rest of my life. The downtime when you're actually doing one live, it's just downtime. And when you can't talk to the people on your team via email, it's not a big deal. But when they're sitting 5 feet away from you and you're waiting for orders to get run, and that obviously takes the referee some time. I fully appreciate that. And they did a very, very good job. But you're just sitting there thinking, I'd love to talk to the guy behind me, but well, he's the enemy and I can't. And the other person across from me, well, I can't let them know what I'm up to because then they'll have inside information that they can't have. So all in all, I like doing this online. I had a really good time with it, so much so that once this one ended, I didn't realize that Jim had started up some other ones. And I jumped in, got a hold of him to jump into the one that's going on right now, the 1807 one. And I'm really glad I'm able to get into that too. We've just sent our initial orders out to him, and I'm waiting for the first things to roll out to see just how badly I've screwed up.
Jim, you've created an addiction.
I think something that Scott said goes to the heart of why a lot of people like this. It's because, and I would tell people this, my goal when I retire, if I ever get around to it, is to run Kriegspiels full time. I'll just have multiple maps up on multiple walls and just go from wall to wall. The thing that people like about doing it this way, one of the big things I think, is the fact that it is a very limited time commitment actually, but it gives you a lot of, it gives you a lot of musing time. My favorite image of Napoleon, bar none, is not him dramatically crossing the Alps. It's a sketch of him lying on the floor on top of a map, and he's sticking pins in the map as he always did. And I think if you have any interest in military history and gaming of military history at all, you've thought that way. You don't have to be Napoleon. You could be Hannibal. You could be Caesar. You could be Patton. You could be Rommel, whoever. You've done that. You've laid at a map. You've looked at a map, and you've wanted to muse. You've wanted to ponder, you know, maybe smoke a cigar or have a drink or just have a cup of tea and do all that. And the pace of this sort of a game, even in the craziest of times, really does allow for
that. Yeah. Again, you know, doing these in person, as Scott mentioned, where we do them at Origins, it's not like we've got our own separate little hidey hole to go do this in. Our area at Origins is right in the middle of the game hall. To the advantage of some and to the detriment of others, there are some folks that would like us to be in a quieter area where you have a little more time to ponder things, where you have a little more, a little bit more calm around you, especially for those longer, more intense games where you've got a couple of hours to really mull over what's happening in those bigger extended war games. But there's others that, you know, part of the reason that we were put on the floor by the original Origins dudes when we were first setting up the wargaming program is they wanted that stop by and take a look kind of traffic. And we saw that in one of the first Kriegspiels that we ran. We did this on a Wednesday night as a freebie because it was sort of our test run, right? I mean, James, Jim, you were the guys running this. That was our demo run. We weren't sure if this was going to work, but give it a try. And so we had all the blinders set up on all the tables, and we had folks walking by going, what the hell's going on? Like, are they studying for the LSAT? You know, I mean, people wondering what we were doing. And once we explained, we had folks, hey, that's really cool. We want to jump into that. And so we were able to work some folks in on Wednesday night, but we had a bunch of folks come back and play Saturday. So many so that, Jim, if I'm not mistaken, I know we had to kick some staff folks out of the game on Saturday night because we had so many paying customers show up. But I think at one point, didn't we have a couple of paying customers we had to turn away that were showing up with generic tokens? We had so many
yes.
people. In,
yep.
Yeah.
No, there was at one point all the carrels were filled and we had two folks come up with generics. And we just unfortunately had some folks that had registered. So no, it was tremendous.
Yeah. Yeah. Priority obviously always goes to reserve tickets. But, you know, that was one of those rare cases where we had literally no seat left at the table that we could sneak somebody into in order to join one of the games there. But, I mean, we were kicking staff people out of the game that wanted to play in order to make space for everybody. Marshall, you mentioned that this was one of the first online ones that you had done, but you've obviously got a lot of experience doing these face-to-face with folks. What did you see as sort of strengths and weaknesses between the online versus the real world type game there?
I think the online gives you a lot of flexibility. As we've already hit the nail on the head in that you have the opportunity to really mull and muse over what is my next response going to be. At the same time, that is sort of a downside of it because if you're actually a military commander out in the field, you don't have that kind of time to mull over your next decision. You've got to generally very quickly make a subsequent decision after the first one. You know, what am I going to do? How am I going to respond? The enemy is in motion as we speak, and I have to react. I have to get inside his OODA loop. I have to dictate to him what the circumstances of the engagement will be, and so on. And that's something that you kind of lose when you have that time to think and muse and mull over your turn. On the other hand, it's like sipping a glass of fine wine. To sit there confronted with the problem, you've got your little map set up, you've got the little pieces on it, and you're just pondering and you're meditating on it and you're thinking about it. And that's where I think the growth and the learning and the experience really comes about. That's where the value is for playing Kriegsspiel online. And as a result of that, I'm trying to do more stuff online. And I might not ever go back to doing it in person. We probably will. The group we'll certainly want to get together in person if the con returns after the current, you know, health situation blows over. But I'm actually quite okay with doing this in an online world because the flexibility is there. We can move it along in real time by playing it, you know, in real time live online, or we can play it by email and have that time to sit and savor the problems and the decision making and the networking. I mean, I wrote like a war diary when I was playing this game. I wrote a couple of entries that I think I sent off to Jim, you know, at the end of the first two nights of the engagement, you know, months apart. But, you know, I just had fun with the character, and that's why I enjoyed playing it by email.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the key, right? We want to have fun with these things. Yeah. I mean, why else would you sign up for a 2.5 year email commitment if you weren't having a good time with it? So, James, I know you have, by force of circumstance, had to shift some of your gaming online as well. But what do you, you've done a ton of in-person Kriegsspiel also. What do you see as some of the things you've enjoyed about online versus face-to-face and things that you like better in one versus the other?
I'm kind of going to be the broken record and repeating things other people have said here. So the great thing about the online is that it's a slower, more contemplative pace. And things come in and you read them over and you have time to sit down and think about them, and then you get your response in. And quite frankly, you put that box in your head away for a week or two, and the umpire moves things forward. And a week or two later, something pops up in your email, and you deal with it back and forth. And in a lot of ways, for a high-level Kriegsspiel, an operational-level Kriegsspiel, that's probably better, because that is a circumstance under which the commander probably should have time to sit back and think. On the other hand, there is also really just nothing like a more tactical Kriegsspiel in person when everything's cooking along well at the umpiring table, so that you are deeply in the dark and you're under time pressure and events are flowing and you've got to try to somehow wrest out of that the fingertip feel of the situation and give the right order at the right time. And that's always amazing. So I love them both. In the end, these are all part of the Church of Kriegsspiel.
It struck me, I had not seen James or his Batman Mike run these before. This is nothing I had seen before Origin. And Mike is a really cool guy who, especially it seems, in the realm of Kriegsspiel, does not suffer fools kindly, even though he's welcoming you to the game environment. And watching him do it and, you know, watching him march up and down, you know, bear in mind, these are people who paid for this experience.
Yes.
You know, these are people at a con, they're on vacation, maybe they just got done playing Candyland or the latest thing to come out from whichever company. And they walk over to this table with these study carols set up and these maps and this briefing. And the next thing they know, they've got this guy who does bear an air of authority marching up and down between them going, orders in 1 minute, orders in 1 minute. And
yeah, you're not nearly loud enough to replicate, Mike, but that's okay because people are probably listening to this podcast on headphones.
Right.
And we don't want to hurt anyone.
You could hear it all the way across a noisy gaming hall. And
when Mike and I run these things, his role is always pit boss. He is making sure that things keep moving forward. And his secondary role is, since often the people we're playing with have little or no clue about Napoleonic warfare, is to sit there and explain and answer their questions and tell them that no, artillery does not fire over friendly troops. It fires through them. And,
right.
So on and so forth.
If I had a dollar for every time he tried to explain that.
Well, but Mike is also, James, Mike's what, 6'2", 6'3"?
Yes, he is, as he likes to say, a large man from Brooklyn.
Yeah, he's a tall dude. He's a loud dude. You know, when he's got the full beard going, he is a very, you know, a visually imposing dude. And when he's stomping around, sort of barking over the tops of the study carrels, it does absolutely get your attention. And he was perhaps the only dude who could consistently compete on the same bus. So,
you know, the only reason I mention that is when you take the example of the Kriegspiel that we just got done playing, and that it's to James's comment that this is all part of the Church of Kriegspiel, those are distant wings one from another.
Yeah.
Because yes, they both have many of the same elements, and yes, we love playing in both, but I played in a couple of them, and I will tell you, as a guy who's played a lot, even my tactical Kriegspiels, when I do the 1824, we've brought in James a couple times to read him down for heresy, because he doesn't exactly play the Kriegspiel as Reiswitz wrote it, which is to say, not at all.
Neither does anybody.
Just speak for yourself.
Well, because nobody's doing it in 19th century German either.
Well, that's true. That's true. But no, I mean, in terms, and I completely understand why he's doing what he's doing. But, you know, even when I do it in my home, when I've done it in my home or for some local Kriegspielers, it's a more, gentlemen, I'm going to be with you in a couple minutes, talk amongst yourselves, have a drink, have a snack, have some of the pizza. I'll be right back with you. I got to run some numbers. And I've got umpires set aside who are helping me run those tables and set up a separate table and all this other stuff. That is not what happened at Origins.
No.
At all. No. And it was for the good. It was for the good. And stepping back from it, I saw just how much it did enforce what Marshall was talking about in terms of the decision-making process, the local, you know, demand on it, your attention span, stay focused, don't drift, because if you do, Mike is going to tell you the clock moved on. Sorry, your battalion just got hit in the flank.
Yeah. Oops, your battalion just got hit in the flank.
Yeah. Well, yeah, except it wasn't so much with the oops. It's like, I think you should know you just got hit in the flank.
Yeah. So I've not played in the online Kriegspiels. The only in-person Kriegspiel I played in was probably 20-ish years ago, and I've absolutely no doubt in my mind that we did most things horribly wrong, but we had a good time, so it was, you know, it all worked out. One of the things that I was struck by with the online Kriegspiel and the way we had discussed it, you know, just amongst ourselves, but then also hearing the descriptions of kind of the differences from our guests tonight, it takes me back to when you and I were doing the Dragon Magazine video podcasts, where we consistently saw advertisements back then for the old play-by-mail games, not play-by-email, but, you know, straight up play-by-mail. Mail us your moves for this, you know, for this game turn, and we will print out and mail the results back to you and ask you for your next moves. And, you know, okay, look, we're not slapping stamps on envelopes anymore, but this really isn't too far off the family tree from what we had originally discussed way back when, is it?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I mean, these companies that evolved in the 70s and 80s, and I suppose before I you know, that was in my time, there's no doubt that there's a part of me that sees being able to do this online and being able to run these things as I have is a little bit of vengeance for all those games, because those were turn-based and those cost money per turn.
Yeah.
You know, you paid to play those games. You got a kingdom and you had to put in your, you know, fill out a form and somebody had input it into a computer and it ran. There's a lot of similarities there. And I always wanted to play in those. They sounded awesome to me. And there were World War II ones, and there were Lace Wars and Napoleonics and Fantasy. And I, you know, my sainted Polish mother was not going to give little Jimmy $1.50 a month to be able to play some games where you got a bunch of printed ASCII characters on a on a perforated sheet of paper. Wasn't going to happen. So yeah, there are in terms of the operational Kriegspiel, there are many similar, and the ability to sort of, I've often said that, one of the things that I, and I've had multiple players tell me this, they have this experience of, oh, I got an email for my turn. Great. I can take a couple minutes and bust out my map and see what's going on. It's a little surprise pops into the day once a week, you know, if I can get that many turns in.
Yeah. Marshall, have you guys just sort of stuck with Napoleonic Kriegsspiels down there in Southern California, or have you guys covered other historical time periods, other historical events?
Yeah, actually, the one time period we've never actually Kriegsspieled is Napoleonic, any Napoleonics. What we've actually done are mostly American Civil War. We most recently did Franco-Prussian War on the Metz map, and we have also run some World War II scenarios, Battle of Moscow, ran a couple, two or three of those. So, yeah, we have done different time periods.
So just this past weekend, you guys were doing an online Kriegsspiel, and I think that was a Civil War game, correct?
Yeah, Battle of Gettysburg, but it was completely fictional Battle of Gettysburg. It was two Union Corps encounter two Confederate Corps. They both had roughly the same orders. Take Gettysburg, secure a road to lead outside of town where you're going to eventually have to exit in the afternoon of the game, and join the rest of the army for the decisive battle off map.
Okay, okay. And so part of the tweak was probably just because people know the Gettysburg scenario so well that you needed something different, right?
Yeah. The one thing I don't want to encounter is somebody saying, well, this particular unit, you know, the 55th, whatever, you know, had these particular, you know, rifles, and they could shoot an extra 50 yards, and I want that bonus calculated and stuff like that. I don't want any of that, you know? So we really just make everything fictional, or at least somewhat fictional. We change the order of battle, or we change certain details. So it's really the players matching up against one another rather than trying to recreate history.
Scott, I think, how many other Kriegsspiel-like games have you played in other than the ones through the Dragoons? Is this something that you've tackled much outside of Dragoon land?
No, it was the one at Origins, and then this one were the only two that I've done, and now starting our third.
So it's just us. So, all right, well, let's dive into a couple of war stories here real quick then about the specific big old Kriegsspiel that Jim, you were shepherding through, and we're going to let each of these guys sort of chime in a little bit on their experiences as commanders in that game, not so much from the gameplay perspective, because we talked a bunch about the different kinds of gameplay, but sort of, you know, what was happening in their command as some of the game was going on. And so I know we've got some of the videos that folks can go back and watch a little bit, but to let these guys give a little first-person perspective around your big view stuff. The scenario we were playing in this one, we're down in Bavaria. Like you said, we've got the French sort of strung out in a couple of different places as Charles' army is bearing down on them. Paint a picture for us. What's, you know, the two sides, and what are they trying to pull off as the battle unfolds?
Sure. And to that end, that is why I've been poking a little bit at my tabletop simulator, which I have right in front of me now, because I wanted to make reference to it, because I figured you'd want to do something a little bit like this. And when you asked me who I thought would be good to have on, the folks I suggested for a variety of reasons, because I think they each have, you know, what is it they say, that war is seeing the elephant? It's the three blind men and the elephant. One of the great things about the Kriegsspiel is what you don't know, and using the best of your ability, the best of your powers, to see as much of it as you possibly can, despite the limits of the situation. And so I kind of wanted to break it out into three pieces, which I call which I inelegantly call the Rosenberg piece. I've got the Rosenberg piece, the Louis Lefebvre piece, and the, and of course, the Van Damme piece, in some ways saving the best for last. the overall situation, as you correctly say, is that Charles, the Archduke Charles, he's got to come in. His overall objective, just like Napoleon's, is kick the French out. The French are here. They're in Bavaria. Get rid of them. They've been here since 1805, essentially, and we want them gone. The French objective is survive and don't get kicked out, and defeat the Austrian. There's a lot of other details, but it really does come down to that. In the first story, which is a very interesting one, it's the Rosenberg story. Right at the center of this battlefield, there's the town of Landshut. It's a city now, but it was fairly substantial back then, but it wasn't nearly as big as it is today. And Landshut is important because it's one of the few ways that the Austrians and the French can transit the Isar River. The Isar is a substantial river. It's also at the center of the road grid.
if you just looked at this map from a road grid perspective, everything north of the Isar funnels into Landshut, and that's where the crossing is made. Well, it fell to the Austrians, and particularly to Rosenberg's command, along with Lewis's command, so we brought both of them together into the same room, to try to punch across the Isar and try to control that crossing. Unlike the 1806 campaign, where it took these guys a couple months in game time to find each other, these folks woke up on the morning of the first day of the Kriegsspiel, and they saw that they had enemies right across the river from them.
Just to clarify for the audience, when you're talking about these guys sort of waking up and the enemies are right across the river or sort of slamming into Landshut there along the Isar River, you're talking about the game as was being played by your guys, not the actual historical scenario, correct?
Correct. Now, these guys weren't that far removed from one of the cool things you do in a Kriegsspiel is the scenario designer, in this case, DDA, Dr. Rui, he says, look, you're set up roughly in this area. And so just like I'm doing now with the 1807 Kriegsspiel, I've got to hear from the various commanders, okay, at the start of the game, and we are, yes, you're right, we're talking about the game. At the start of the game, tell me where your people are. Where exactly are you? And one of the situations that became interesting almost immediately was that Marshal Lewis, he's a field commander. Why is this failing me? Field Marshal Lewis. He's also a prince. Field Marshal Lewis. He and Rosenberg, played by James Stewart, are both confronting Marshal Lefebvre, played parenthetically for those who know him by Jim Lacy. And so they're across from each other right at the beginning, and they immediately set to each other in a series of both military and non-military attempts to dislodge each other from their position.
When you're saying non-military attempts, Marshall, what were some of the non-military attempts you were using to dislodge each other?
Well, my understanding was, first of all, I didn't know historically who Lefebvre actually was, but I knew that he was commanding a division or a corps of Bavarian troops. And from my understanding, the Bavarians were not particularly happy with the French. So the other player engaged me in sort of a dialogue suggesting that he would be interested in defecting and joining the Austrian cause, which would deprive the French of a whole corps, gain us a corps. And all I had to do was simply arrange this defection, make sure this defection could occur. And so I was very intrigued with this possibility. I was like, is this part of the scenario? Is this something that happened historically? I actually own a copy of the module. I put it in storage so I wouldn't look at it for 2 or 3 years or whatever. and so I didn't even crack that open. I just rolled with it. And I'm like, well, I engaged in a dialogue with this other player, and he very much indicated, yes, you know, I'm going to defect to your side. And what that ended up doing was delaying an attack. I certainly wasn't going to do anything to antagonize him. And he kept laying out certain conditions. And I can't remember the details on the conditions, but it was basically something like, I couldn't do this and I had to do this. And basically he was stalling me and delaying me, which I recognize in hindsight. But at the moment I was like, we're going to bag a French core turn the tables on the French. This is really exciting. I was pretty happy.
And because we've only got, you know, like an hour left on this podcast, go ahead and give us the spoiler. Did they defect or were they screwing with you?
No, he was messing with me, and I was my character was absolutely enraged. And personally, I was delighted. I thought it was hilarious. He got me, you know. But my character was enraged when I learned about Lefebvre. I'm mispronouncing the name. When I learned that he was a commoner who was promoted through the ranks, I refused to refer to him as Marshal. I referred to him as the commoner, and I vowed to hang him. And we ended up, of course, fighting. You know, the battle did take place. I was pretty, you know, he got the better of me. What can I say? How naive was I?
And Jim, was this intentionally set up as a Did you sort of coach the opposing commander to tempt him along with this, or is this something that was concocted entirely on their own out of the scenario?
This is one of those moments that every umpire faces in a Kriegsspiel where the player comes up with something that is not in the book. And
you roll with it, huh?
And you go, well, you try. My goal as an umpire is always, all right, let's give it a shot and see what happens. If it goes too far, I'll say so. But this was just goofy enough. I mean, look, and the pages of all this history are filled with insane things. You know, during the 1805 campaign, two French marshals basically convinced a city to surrender by themselves.
Yeah.
You know, so this stuff isn't impossible. But no, to answer your question, this was Jim thinking this up entirely on his own. The reality of it was he was stuck. He had placed one of his divisions down in Munich to hold it. And what he didn't know is that John Gill, the author of the books Thunder on the Danube, and Lance, who is currently playing Napoleon, actually, in the 1807 Kriegsspiel, Lance had decided that they were going to punch straight across the Isar into Munich with the very best troops in the Austrian army. So within about 5 hours of the start of the game, the Austrians seized Munich by a coup de main.
Okay.
And so this set of troops that Lefebvre sent down river is shattered. I mean, he loses, they're right here. I've got them on the map. He loses 5,000 guys in about 3 hours. Next.
They were right here yesterday.
They were right here along with the city they were parked in. So, you know, that's bad news one. Bad news two is Cor Rosenberg and Cor Lewis are now sitting facing him across this Sole Bridge at Landshut. He's got two divisions and Bavarian cavalry to hold against four divisions of infantry and three of cavalry. The only thing he's got going for him is the terrain, which leads me to the story of James Sterrett, who decided he was tired of trying to push across the bridge at Landshut directly and observed that, yes, the Austrians had a pontoon bridge.
So James, tell us about said pontoon bridge.
Well, actually, I didn't have the pontoon bridge, sadly. I think things would have gone better for us if we had. But while this negotiation was going on, and like Marshall, I was sitting there thinking, you know, if we pull this off, that would be awesome. But I was also not sure what was going on. And I was really, really not sanguine about the prospects that we faced of trying to attack across a bridge, because that's a powerful defensive position. So I figured that, you know, while that's going on, I have engineers. I can build a bridge out of sight down the Isar. So I have my corps quietly slip away. We build a bridge across the Isar. We get the corps across the Isar, and we start marching onto Lefebvre's flank, figuring that that way, Marshall can pin him at the bridge. I can take him in the flank. We'll destroy him that way. And then we can continue in our mission of protecting the flank of the main Austrian effort, which is headed off to our right in order to take Regensburg.
So I get across
the bridge, and I'm marching towards Lefebvre, and I start to come under attack. So I'm deploying to face whoever it is who's fighting, and the force gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and it eventually becomes clear that I am fighting the entire corps of Marshal Davout, which is not only the best corps on the map, it's the biggest, which was sort of a horrific moment for me, because I kind of knew at that point, this is not a fight I'm going to win. And the question is, what do I need to do? Because my mission is still protecting the flank. So do I stand and die and get crushed by Davout there and hope that I do enough damage to him that it slows him down? Or do I try to get my corps back across the river and maintain a force in being? So I decide that I have to get back my corps back across the river and maintain a force in being. And in the process, I sacrifice one of my divisions in pretty much cold blood as the rear guard and then the poor bastards who are stuck on the other side of the river when I destroyed the bridge.
Yeah,
so
I don't know if I survived the war. They did. They are currently, they were marched, and it was amazing how long it took them to get there. They got marched all the way back to Ingolstadt, where they were held prisoner.
If their commander survived the war, I fully expect him to challenge me to a duel once he gets out of it. Because basically, I left him there and hung him out to dry. So I get my forces on the Austrian side of the river again. We've destroyed the bridge. We're down a division. I march back to where Marshall is. at Longchamp in order to help him out. And my troops are tired and they're feeling shattered and I'm resting. And as we're resting, what should we learn of? But there is a French force coming from the right up our side of the river. So I'm deploying to defend against this new threat. And as luck would have it, or non-luck would have it, it's Dafoe, who has gone marching all over the place to find another bridge, has gone over it, and is coming to get me again, whether or not he realized it was me. So we defended, and I realized that at this point, holding Landshut was important enough that doing whatever I could to maul Dafoe was worth it. And that was the end of my corps. I stood and died. I offered to Jim to lead the last charge, but for reasons that only he knows, he decided that I survived it.
You could be here to tell this story and or be on the receiving end of the duel from the prisoner of Ingolstadt.
There you go.
The prisoner of Ingolstadt. That was the first draft of the prisoner of Zenda.
I think I sent a division to you, James, at the last minute.
Yes.
I think I sent my best division to help you out.
You did. Yeah. You tried to march them over the bridge at Landshut to assist him. Here's the thing, and it's unfortunate that Marshal Barrington, he of Command Post Games and others who played Dafoe, who I did adjudge the MVP of the Kriegsspiel, couldn't be with us because, you know, he's a guy that's, you know, he's built games. He sells games that are based on the Kriegsspiel. So he certainly understands the principles, but he would have made Dafoe proud. His task was initially defending Ratisbon. That's where he starts out. He never defends it. He says, you know what? Bugger Regensburg. I'm gone. He leaves one brigade to sort of present just in case the Austrians might be intimidated by this. He marches from Regensburg down to Landshut, where he crashes into James's right flank, defeats him or drives him off there. Having driven him off, he abandons Lefebvre, who's wondering where he got off to, marches all the way to Landau, which is a long distance behind him, crosses there, comes all the way back where he hits James again. And yeah, he had no idea it was you. He just was determined to make his way back. Shatters that corps, then continues to march all the way down to Erding, which is not far from Munich. The only thing that keeps him from still marching is his troops are shot. Yeah. I mean, I'll give you one of the best units he's got is Saint-Hilaire's division. They start out with 10,000 men, largely due to fatigue. By the time the game ends, they're down to below 6,000 men. They lose over 4,000 guys to straggling, you know, so it's insane. But so that's the part he plays. But in all this, as Dafoe leaves Ratisbon behind, one of the guys that marches up there is General Van Damme. And General Van Damme opens up Scott's part of this story, which in some ways, I awarded him the Medal of Cassandra in the Kriegsspiel for being the prophet that nobody believed. I'll let him tell you. Scott, what were you telling Napoleon for roughly 2 years?
Where the Austrians were. Where almost all of them were. At least it looked to me like they were all there. Now, during the Kriegsspiel, my computer ate about a year's worth of the email. So I lost a lot of the original details I had. But I actually still have my original hand-drawn map where I plotted out in different colored highlighters where all my plans were. And my initial plan that we had worked out is I was going to go to Landshut. But as I saw what and pieced together what was going on, I realized that we had a lot of guys down there. And I was pretty sure if I got there, it was just going to cause a giant, you know, it would be a giant traffic jam. And I was going to cause more harm than good. My secondary plan was to head down to Freising. And it turned out it really felt like it was the same situation. And I knew that we had a small force, that Dafoe had left a small force up in Ratisbon. And so my final third backup plan was to march up to Ratisbon. And when I got to just outside of, Abensburg, and nobody really seemed to need me, and any place else I could go was just going to cause a mess, I thought, I'm going north. I'll see what I can find there. And that's where I showed up to what I thought was Ratisbon under siege. I'm pretty sure I was wrong. I'm pretty sure the siege was over and Dafoe's men had already run away to I don't even know where. But I had no idea. I thought they were still in there, and I thought they were setting up the siege, not tearing it down. And I honestly don't know when they actually realized I was there. I'm assuming it's after most the forces left, because otherwise I'm sure I would have been completely and totally devastated because they had too many people there.
Can I insert here? I want you to keep going because this is just so delightful. You paralyzed them.
Really?
Just so everybody understands, Scott shows up with a division of Württemberg cavalry.
No. Napoleon had taken my Württemberg cavalry.
Oh, right. I'm sorry, your infantry, your Württemberg infantry. He shows up with this, and immediately I have to, because that's my obligation, I have to inform the Charles, who at the time was in Regensburg, and he has taken Regensburg hours before. However, and this is one of the biggest howevers of the game, one of the great, you know, counterfactuals. Marshall, remember I told you that Davout goes over to Landau and crosses the Isar?
Yeah.
If you take a right at Landau, you cross the Isar. If you take a left, you head up to a town called Straubing. And Straubing is one of the key crossings over the Danube that allow the Austrians to get home if they get into real trouble. It's one of the key spots in their lines of communication. Davout cuts loose one division of cavalry under Saint-Sulpice, who chases off the guard that Charles has left guarding that spot. So the message he gets right as Scott shows up in front of Ratisbon is, oh my God, we've been driven out of what's Oberschneiding. It's a town south of Straubing. The French are pushing north. Charles freaks out. Not only does he march two corps back to defeat one division of cavalry, but Dom de Ballo, great dude, and I believe a Kriegspiel of your own association, Marshall, who is playing Marshal Hiller, he immediately freezes and prepares to be attacked rather than to attack Vendamme.
All I knew that, is that,
folks,
I looked...
that is Kriegspiel in a nutshell. Where the fog of war is so thick, you can't freaking tell what the size of the forces is, and you have to take the character test.
I think all of us
at some point fail.
I think I spent two game days digging in defensively just because I was so convinced that I was going to get just run over like nothing else. And at this point, I still thought that they had not sieged the city. I thought that we still had men in there, and I thought, all right, you know what? I'm getting to the point where I can either sit here or I can treat this kind of like a D&D game and just make stuff up and see what happens. Kind of like what happened now that I know about with the, sure, we'd love to defect. So I thought, let's try to parlay. And I'd actually just been watching The Watchmen on HBO, and there's a scene in there where the two of the characters that don't like each other send each other tomatoes or something. So I asked Jim, I was like, can I have tomatoes? And I tried to get them to parlay with me over breakfast and kept telling about how delicious the tomatoes were. And I can only imagine I confused them even more given what you're telling me about the situation now. My original plan was to try and get them to, you give me the men in the city, I'll give you the city. There's no honor in us just dying needlessly over a city. You're going to be sieging it forever. And, you know, I can get you from the rear. They can get you from the inside. We're going to be just stuck here. There's no honor in that. Give me the guys. We'll go fight someplace where there's actually honor involved. And then the cavalry that Napoleon took that I had completely forgotten that I even had showed back up. And at that point, I thought, oh, I actually might have some numbers. And that's when the countdown on the forum started, and I realized, well, crap, the game's about to end. And I really thought about just going ahead and attacking, but I realized, no, I'm going to play this out as though it was still that I didn't have the knowledge that we're winding down and play it out the right way. And then seeing the after action report and seeing that I always knew that the Austrians had reinforcements that were likely to come from the north. I didn't realize how close they were to me. And I was just amazed that we stared at each other that long and that I paralyzed them in any way, because they could have completely, I believe Jim's quote to me was they would smoke me like a ham. And I'm sure that they absolutely would have. And that's why ultimately at the end, because throughout all 30 months that we did this, I essentially went on a stroll through the countryside. I never got into a single fight the entire time. And I just wanted my guys to fight something. And that's why I asked them to simulate at the end just to see what if, what would happen. Because at the same time, so I found out that historically on April 23rd, 1809, the day that things started wrapping up, there was actually a giant battle for Ratisbon. And I thought, wow, it was almost historic. But, you know, we won. So I'm happy with that result. And that actually, I believe, was the historic result, too. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, it was a really, it was just a fascinating time. And especially when I just started trying to come up with silly ways just to try and mess with the other side. That made it fun.
The other thing I will say, and I want to give Scott a lot of credit for, his emails were priceless. I mean, there's... The greatest email I received, bar none, goes to John Gill, who I think I've told this story, but I will tell it till I die. I carry this with me till I die. Charles, Jason Pratt, had been in the habit of sending his messages out in poetry or something like that, trying to conceal it from the French. Because part of the problem is, as I've shared in the AARs, the French actually had a troop of horse on top of the major Austrian line of communication. Because of the way my son rolls dice against the Austrians, he's not sorry. He's not sorry. There he is. About 2 in 6 Austrian messages were intercepted. But, you know, because of that and because of the whole situation, he tried to send things in German. John Gill, who is quite the scholar, he sends along a message intended for his crew, explaining the situation, what's going on in Munich and all this other stuff. And it's entirely in German. I know it's a poem, but it's only when I read it and start translating it that I realize he's done it to the tune and cadence of All Along the Watchtower.
It's incredible.
I actually have it framed in my office. I mean, it's truly beautiful.
So he's doing Dylan tunes in German.
Yeah, he's doing Dylan tunes in German, but it also communicated what was going on. It wasn't the Dylan lyrics. It was his lyrics that he wrote in German, trying to explain to Charles, hey, yeah, by the way, we're in real trouble down here. So
that's there are so many layers to that story there. First of all, I mean, there's a reason that Velcro dice have become a famed thing on Saturday Night Fights. Your
right.
son's proficiency with the dice is rapidly gaining a good amount of fame. The story of Scott sort of finding the entire Austrian army harkens back to the story of a scout platoon leader one time on a very lonely hilltop out at Fort Irwin with the radio call of, guys, I'm pretty sure I found the Krasnovian main body. Yes. How many of them are there? Pretty sure there's all of them. Are you sure? Well, if there's not, then I'm real curious who's left out there that's not in this main body, you know, because there were so many of them. So it sounds as though Scott completely unintentionally found the main body and nobody wanted to believe him, huh?
Right. And that's the thing. His emails, although they do not rise quite to the poetic level, were my second favorites in the whole Kriegsspiel, because they were saying, sir, to Napoleon, sir, they're, it was almost, you can imagine the guy whispering into his walkie-talkie, sir, they're all here, sir. What do you mean all? I mean all, sir. By my count, I see all.
Yes.
You know,
again, but, like, if they're not all here, there aren't very many of them anywhere else, right?
I don't know what you all are fighting. There's two other pieces to this. He's quite correct that Napoleon had shipped back his cavalry late in the game, and they showed up just a little bit to his east. But that spot, just by fate, was the left flank of the Austrians facing him on the south side of the Danube. And so he sends him a message going, don't engage him, but scare him. And sure enough, Dom, great dude, sees, what do I got to tell him? You see a division of cavalry appear on your left flank. What does he do? Oh my God, I've got to refuse my left flank.
Yeah.
And then the other piece is our friend Vance, otherwise known as he who took a long walk in the Bohemian Alps. You know, he shows up 3 days into the battle, by which point it's almost entirely over, and just kind of starts wandering around. And so he would have, had he turned a certain way, wound up behind Scott. But again, you talk about James' point about the communication and the ability to coordinate. Dom knew exactly where Scott was. There was no question. Like he said, he was throwing up he was throwing up, you know, dirt. He was putting in trenches, for God's sake. He knew exactly where he was. This is real 17th
century
stuff. At
that point, Scott's not moving.
He's not going anywhere. He's not maneuvering. And yet at no point did Dom or Charles, or who's the other guy? Bellegarde up there. Say, should we punch south and get rid of this guy?
Yeah.
I was
generally when you're digging in trenches, you're staying put. Nobody digs trenches on their way out of town.
Right. I was always consistently surprised that nobody in the Ratisbon AO said, hey, you know, there's this French corps floating around down here. Should we mop it up? It just never happened.
Should we take care of them?
I was equally surprised.
Scott put on a convincingly, you know, sufficiently convincing threat, you know, that nobody wanted to mess with it. So,
and you know, quite honestly, for a while, there was a while that we didn't even hear from whoever was playing Napoleon. It was quite a while. It felt like he was absent. I don't know if he was just had real life issues that took him out, or if all of our communications were being intercepted. But I think at one point, didn't one of the marshals actually talk about trying to replace him?
Yes.
And at that point, I started wondering what was going on. At that point, I thought perhaps we were getting fake communications from the Austrians, and I was about ready to, I wasn't sure what I was going to do at that point, but luckily at that point, then I'm assuming the real Napoleon showed back up and started telling, well, then he took my cavalry, but,
Well, and the other thing is that, and this is something that I know that Lance is trying to deal with in the 1807 campaign very, very directly and passionately. You know, one of the things you learn about a Kriegsspiel of any kind, we assume a level of communication in the 21st century that tends to create laziness in a Kriegsspiel. You know, it always interests me to see, even if it's a note, even if it's just a line, how many people will say, I'm doing this, I'm doing this. You know, John Gill, to his great credit, every time he did something consequential, he'd sent Charles a note.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
now, keeping now, mind him updated. You, now, mind you, as I said, 33% of those things wound up in French hands. But yeah. that communication piece is always very interesting for me to watch.
And I can tell you, look, even in the 21st century, that level of forethought does not exist in a great many people, because it's something that, you know, when I was in uniform, you know, something that I had dealt with quite a bit in some of the exercises that we had run, where I'm sitting in a command post and the whole point is to train the command post. And, you know, look, some of you guys are going to recognize this as soon as I'm talking about this, kind of what the analog is, but you've got your maneuver units out there. They're all looking at the computer terminals actually fighting the battle. But the whole point is the computer terminal is really just generating the situation that they're communicating back to the command post under relatively realistic conditions. You've got all the radio traffic coming in as you're sitting there trying to manage the battle and plot a fight and see what's going on. And folks that have played in some of our command post exercises at Origins will recognize something very similar to this. It's amazing how often you get a quick report from a company commander somewhere that, hey, I'm taking fire from this direction, and then they're gone. Like, for 20 minutes, you don't hear anything, and the next time they pop up on the net, they're like three grid squares away, and they're down two tanks and a Bradley, and they've knocked out, you know, an enemy company. And it's like, for 20 minutes, you got nothing. And look, that's now. That's with instant radio, et cetera, et cetera. And you don't necessarily expect blow-by-blow updates on the radio every minute as you go along. But there's enough people floating around in most mechanized teams, whether it's a tank team or an infantry team, floating around out there. Somebody can get on a radio and just say, we've moved two grid squares to the west, you know, that you've at least got a rough location of where they might be, so that, you know, you're not accidentally dropping artillery on your own guys or whatever it may be. That's today with current comms. So the fact that somebody was being that proactive with archaic comms is great. I mean, that's a testament to that guy's overall sort of vision of how those things should be running. So that's good to see. Marshall, what was something that, aside from the in-game surprise of this guy kind of screwing with you, am I going to defect, am I not going to defect, he's sort of pinning you in place by subterfuge, what was one of the more surprising things that came out of this Kriegsspiel for you, given your relative experience with all kinds of other Kriegsspiel stuff?
I didn't move anywhere. I spent the whole game, you know, on one side or the other of this bridge. That was pretty remarkable to me. I had some expectation that I would be, that there'd be some kind of maneuver, that something would happen. In fact, one of the big decisions that a commander typically gets to make is, how am I going to get to the battle? How am I going to approach a certain situation via the route that I'm going to take to get there? And then my next decision is, where am I going to commit my force? When and where am I going to commit? And those decisions were essentially predetermined for me based on this force that was sitting on the other side of this bridge. And I never got to march anywhere. You know, I was more or less stuck in place. I burned up a full day of game time, you know, exchanging notes and, you know, exchanging love notes with a person who didn't love me back. And then, you know, I ended up pushing across the bridge, I think. And then I had this prize, and then I was stuck with the prize. I had to hold it. I couldn't leave. And it turned out to not be much of a prize after all.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you. I'm not going to hold that to your charge. I think if I were to criticize, and I never criticize Kriegsspiel players in any sort of, what do I say, attacking way. But if I were to make a comment, if I had a big concern, it's that the Austrians let far too much stuff sit north of the Danube or in that immediate area of the Danube. If they had come south in the numbers I really did expect them to, just like Davout did. And as frankly, as they were starting to do as the game wore down, your holding of that left flank, as James pointed out, of that advance would have been absolutely critical. Because the ability to hold, you know, you can't have Lefebvre operating over there. You've got to clear it out, hold that, because in addition to being their left flank, it's a logical line of retreat if you need it.
Right. Yeah, I was stuck there, but it was all right. I still had a great time.
Yeah.
Hey, in the end, we accomplished our mission at that bridge. We held it for the Austrian army. We kept Lefebvre from messing with the flank, and there's probably not so much we could have done to keep Davout from messing with anything he felt like messing with.
So. At least not until he ran out of gas. Yeah.
Where's my medal?
James, you may have seen this some over the years. It's a lesson that I actually saw play out in an exercise once, where we happened to have, you know, a 4-star general roaming around because he was bored and wanted to go watch what was going on. And you know, he's talking to this terrified captain and a couple of lieutenants rehearsing some stuff on the map board. And one of the questions he asked is, you know, what was the commander's intent that you got? The commander's intent was allow no penetration of phase line blue or whatever the hell the phase line was, and maintain at least 60% combat power for future operations, something like that. And one of the key questions in all of that was, okay, if you can only do one or the other, which one is more important to your commander? And the captain was a little dumbfounded because he'd never really pondered that. But in all fairness, you know, like everybody else in the room's looking around going, well, crap, I don't know that I know the answer to that. Like, all of us were stuck on that. And it comes back to, you know, sort of what's the commander's intent and why? Is it, you know, is that no penetration line because you got an absolute, you know, die to hold this sort of defense line? Or is the maintaining combat power more important because you've got a follow-on mission that's getting ready to come and the boss knows that that's on the way? And so sometimes, you know, like you mentioned, you happen to holding that bridge allowed you to hold the flank, allowed you to thwart some of the opponent's plans. You didn't have to die in place to do it necessarily, but you might have if it had come to that. You know, when your commander's intent comes out there, especially when you're in a low comms environment, kind of like a Kriegsspiel, kind of like the 19th century, those little snippets of guidance that you do get become really important, because that's everything you're hanging your hat on. And so, James, I think that's an important point. You guys accomplished what you thought you had of your mission, right? Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yes. I really, there were many moments where I was trying to get into my opponent's head, and I didn't know if he, like at one point, I think he kind of fell back. At another point, he had attacked me, and I actually defended and held. At another point after that, I think he fell back, and I didn't know if I should pursue him or if he was trying to bait me into a trap. But one of the things that I kept going over my head is, what does he want me to do? I'm going to do the opposite. And I was consistently trying to do the opposite of what I perceived my opponent wanted me to do. I perceived he wanted me to pursue him, so I'm going to stay put. I'm not going to pursue. You know, I perceive he wants me to retreat. I'm going to stay put and defend. But I was always trying to think, what does my opponent want me to do? And of course, I don't know how much that I got right or got wrong. But I was, you know, I felt a little bit like a little mini Sun Tzu, in that I was going to do the opposite of what the enemy expected. But the fog of war really gets, it really messes with your head, and that's all part of the fun.
I've got a question for the players here. And so, Jim, don't jump in on this just yet, because I'm curious from the player's perspective on this. But for the three, we all know it's a game. We all know that as best as possible, you're trying to stay in character in the game. And so as you're composing your emails, how you're writing and how you're phrasing things and how you're approaching things, again, you're trying as best you can to play into what we think of today as how 19th century personalities would have behaved in the situation and all. But again, this is a game, right? Nobody actually died as a result of any of this. And so I'm curious if you ever had a moment where you were just thinking pure gameplay, all right, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. It's time. Scott, you mentioned right there at the end, should I just go ahead and attack? Did you ever get the urge to just scream Leroy Jenkins and just go charge just to make something happen, because it's a game and you want to make something happen? Scott, you alluded to that kind of right towards the end of the game. How often did that urge actually hit you?
Oh, I couldn't tell you how many times that happened. I can think of at least during the last day of that game, at least three or four times where I started to type up a long detailed email to Jim saying, here's how I'm going to attack. And then I thought, no, I wouldn't actually do that. If this was real, I wouldn't do that. And I didn't want to possibly screw up things for all the other people who I were assuming were doing everything as though it was real too. So there were many times that I really, really wanted to, but I resisted the urge. I held back because I wasn't sure who was winning. I didn't know who was losing. Now I will be honest. If I had the impression that we were done, we were toast, yeah, I definitely would have just done it just to do it to see what happened. But I had no idea. Credit to the messengers. I don't know how the hell they know where all of our other people are. I send a message out and suddenly I get replies. How the messengers find each other, I don't know, because I didn't know where half our forces were. But, you know, credit to them. They managed to get messages to and from us. But even then, I had such a little idea where anyone was, and I didn't know exactly how they were doing, that I up until the end, I had no idea if we were going to win or lose. I had no idea how we were doing, because the communication between us was good, but it wasn't that good. It wasn't like I was sitting there looking at the map going, oh, well, you know, we took Munich. We barely held on to it, but we got it back. You know, hey, we're doing fine. I had no idea. I had no idea that Munich had ever fallen, had ever been retaken. I knew we had people south of me. I think everybody was south of me except for the Austrians. And
you're not wrong.
But I mean, ultimately, yeah, there were many times where I thought, I'm going to treat this as just as a pure game, just to see what happens. But I held back because I knew that wasn't what I was supposed to do. And I wanted to keep the experience true to what it was supposed to be.
James, you already mentioned, like, you know, you marched halfway down the river and built your own bridge to go off on your own tangent there somewhere. In all of that, did you ever get the urge to just sort of, you know, fix bayonets and charge just cause?
Honestly, that's not something that I tend to suffer from in Kriegsspiel, in part because the thing that I like about being a player in Kriegsspiel is the fact that it's an opportunity to walk. It's really not a mile in their shoes. It's 10 feet in their socks at best. But it seems to me that the thing that's interesting and different and worth doing about it is that 10 feet in their socks is trying to put myself in their place. So while I'm pretty terrible at doing the role-playing part of writing up the notes and character and all of that, I do a bad job of that. I do try to sit there and say, okay, you know, this is what I know. This is the mission I've got. How am I going to accomplish this mission? And I don't really have much trouble in staying with that because it's where I want to be. So I don't have a lot of urge to, oh, screw it, let's just go do something. Right. that whole cross the river and attack on the flank thing was in service to the mission. It's something that Marshall and I discussed, and we'd figured out how we were going to do it and how it was going to work. And it wound up blowing up in our faces, my face particularly. But honestly, I don't think it was an inherently bad idea from the get-go, because if we had pulled it off and Tavu had not happened to be there, a big if, then I think Lefebvre would have been toast.
It sounds like you just had the dumb luck to build a bridge directly into the teeth of the best force the opponent had on the field.
Yeah, it's all the things you don't know. And in this case, one of the things I didn't know ripped my core apart. But that's the way that's the way the cookie crumbles.
It's not like that doesn't ever happen in real life either. So
absolutely. So. And it's therefore part of the experience.
Yeah. Marshall, look, you spent your whole time as a toll collector there on the bridge. Did you ever get the urge to go Leroy Jenkins on somebody somewhere?
Actually, no. I was just trying to execute my mission as best I could. I do have a massive sense of humor. In fact, oftentimes I try to be cute and funny when I probably shouldn't be. I'm sure it's relatively insufferable for people who know me. But when it comes to playing Kriegsspiel, I try to take it pretty serious, and I really try to put myself in the shoes of the person. I try to role play, because for me that's part of the fun, and I get to express a little bit of humor through the role play. But then when it comes to actually making the decisions, I really stay right on mission. As an umpire, a person who runs games, I don't like it when players go Leroy Jenkins, if you will. In fact, I had a player do that just this last weekend in our big game, and I tend to punish that. You know, I generally don't intervene in a game, it just bothers me because it kind of breaks the game. And I would prefer people kind of put their head into the scenario and take it a little bit seriously. I don't mind having fun with it, but going full Leroy Jenkins is something I prefer players not do. And it's not something I've ever really wanted to do myself as a player.
Jim, as we start to wrap up some of this conversation here, for you as the umpire, what was one of the most surprising and illuminating moments of this whole experience for you over the 2.5 years?
I love watching the machine think. You know, I love watching the perceptions that people have, what is true and what is false. I love the aha moments. I'll give my big three. I think that what John Gill and Lance were able to do down near Munich, where they were wildly outnumbered and yet did their very best to bob, weave, and fence, if you will, against the advancing French, was really, really good. It was great stuff. And yeah, they lost in the end. And yes, they were going to lose outnumbered 3-1, but they made the very best of it. Davu and his utter contempt for the plan, and just, I'm going to go where the problem is, and I'm going to punch something in the face. You know, I'm going to find the enemy, fix the enemy, and destroy the enemy to the best of my ability. It might have caught him had it
not
worked.
Sounds like a cavalryman.
Yeah, it might have caught him if it hadn't have worked out. But, you know, hey, there's a lot of stuff in military history that, if it didn't work out, would have been a really bad idea in retrospect.
There's a few things that did work out that were still really bad.
Yeah, right. There were still bad plans. It was very, very enjoyable. And I hope it was for Scott, as frustrating as it was, to watch him sort of go, just try to tell the French high command, guys, if you're looking for the Austrians, I know where they are.
Yeah, I found them.
You know, that was cool.
I have to say, listening to Marshall and James talk about how they had these very, you know, this is my mission, this is what I'm going to do, this is what I need to do, I didn't really feel like I had that. I think Napoleon's main message to me, once I told him, hey, I found them, was just don't die. And I guess I pulled that part off. I didn't lose a man the entire game. But it's just fascinating hearing that you guys had, we're going to hold this bridge, we're going to do this. And I'm just kind of like, all right, I'm just not going to get killed. Okay. But I didn't get in a fight point of view. Yeah, you're right. I didn't get into an exciting fight, but that doesn't mean it wasn't fun. if it wasn't fun, I wouldn't be jumping into the 1807 one with you right now. And quite honestly, I'm incredibly impressed at how good of a job you did. I mean, you know, if I sent you an email, you quickly got back to me, and you would get back to me not just with details, but if I asked for it, would have little screenshots. You've given us, you put together a tabletop simulator mod for us to use for the 1807, which is hopefully going to help me have a slightly better idea where people are and what's going on this time around. But no, Jim, you did an amazing job. And to do this for 30 months is, you know, it's really impressive. I mean, I know for us, it was responding to an email every now and then. I can only imagine how many you had to weed your way through, and not only to weed your way through, but to get to the right people and then to manipulate everything on the board and to get it all done and to get it done smoothly is incredibly impressive.
If I can second that, I am very well aware of the workload involved in putting these on, particularly when you're putting them on by mail or email. And I am profoundly grateful for the opportunity to play in a Kriegsspiel, since generally all the others I get involved in, I have to run.
Yeah.
So that's been really great. Thank you.
I can tell you, because I know there's involvement here. I've received my last set of orders for 1807, so that's kicking off too. And it's like I say, the joy is watching the ant farm think. But you're very welcome. You're very kind. Thank you.
And I want to third the sentiments of the other two players. I really appreciate it because, again, I am often having to run these. This gave me an opportunity to actually play, and it was just a great time. Just like I said, it's like sitting there and savoring a glass of fine wine. It was kind of that experience, and I really enjoyed those moments when I was able to sit there and ruminate over my little map that I had printed out with the little Kriegsspiel pieces I had put on it and just think, and it was fantastic, and I want to thank you for that experience.
Jim, one of the challenges that we've had as observers, as not players, I'm speaking for all the rest of us that weren't in the game, is it's fairly maddening to watch the forum posts go by of, all right, it's 1600 on Saturday, get your orders in, and then that's it. Like, the next post is, okay, it's 2000 on Saturday, get your emails in. Like, those of us on the outside sort of wondering what's going on are stuck sitting around for 2.5 years waiting for the AAR to show up. That I don't think, because you don't want any leakage to get to the players with outside information, there's no good practical way for us on the outside to observe what's happening as it's happening, is there?
No, I mean, you know, in a perfect world, you know, in the next couple of days, I'm going to shoot the opening setup for 1807 and talk about what people seem to be doing. Because, you know, to tease a little bit, one of the incredible joys is when the two sides sit down to plans and you see them and you go, oh, that's how that's going to go.
Yeah.
You know, you can
realize they're going to perfectly miss each other. Right.
Right. Or drive straight into each other. Or like you say, do a do-si-do around each other, you know?
Yeah.
And the other thing is some people and look, I love people. You spoke very kindly, all three of you, about the amount of work I put in, and I appreciate that. But there's some folks that put in some real effort into planning their moves. I mean, some really, you know, especially the commanders this time. We've got two great commanders, and they are really taking this seriously. And I'm looking at their plans going, yeah, that piece ain't going to work. It's going to run. That clock is going to run for about X hours, and then everything's going to go sideways, promise you. So I would love to share that. I would love to share that. But as you correctly say, it is awful, awful hard to sneak people over to the table without, you know, potentially lifting the fog of war for those who are playing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is one of those things where in the real world, it's a little easier to pull off because you can just sort of amble over to the control table and sort of take a look at what's happening from the big map. And then, you know, as an outside observer, I can kind of, you know, walk over and sort of peek over Scott's shoulder at the study carrel that's set up there and, you know, sort of see what Scott thinks is happening and then go back over to the control map and go, oh, that's what's really happening. And sort of get that bigger picture as it's happening instead of having to wait until the end. And so I think, you know, it is while understanding the necessity of it, it is still sort of a bummer for those of us observing the game as it is going on to not be able to sort of observe it as it's happening, but have to wait until the end to get it all at once. So, Jim, right now we have the 1807 Kriegsspiel is kicked off. You've got a full house of players for that one, correct? There's no empty seats waiting to be filled on this one.
There are not.
Yeah. Which is not a surprise given how much fun everybody seemed to have had with the last one, that anybody that could get involved with this one has jumped in. I know we've got Saturday Night Fights and Wednesday Night Warfare and everything else. Right now, I don't think there's any other Kriegsspiels that you are leading the charge on or any others that we're busy prepping over with the Dragoons other than the ongoing one that you've got right now, correct?
Well, I'm actually running one based on Snappy Nappy. For those who have ever seen the version of the campaign in a day that is run by Snappy Nappy, done by the great folks over at Little Wars TV, we're running one of those, trying to run it as a Kriegsspiel. I'm learning a lot of lessons about time zones and about schedules and things like that. So it's a James is in that one and he's busy. We're just going to say he's busy. And so we do have that going on, but that one too is filled. So I've got that one going on and the 1807, which is just getting ready to kick off. And then, so that's plenty for my plate.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just, you know, as folks have been listening to this podcast and going, man, that sounds really cool. How do I get involved with that? Sort of, I don't think we have any current open seats at the table with the Dragoons at the moment. So the best recommendation is pop in the forums, wait for somebody to say, hey, we've got one coming up. And then the next one shows up. And so, Marshall, you had put a note in our forums looking for some folks to come play this past weekend for the Gettysburg game. Mm-hmm. You'd actually email me personally. I had a rare Saturday off. I was actually working around the house. That doesn't normally happen. Normally I'm watching Jim's Saturday Night Fights from the concessions desk at the soccer facility. And so what's the next one you guys have coming up that somebody would be able to jump into, bearing in mind that, you know, this podcast is going to go live like 10 days later as we're recording it. So, you know, looking forward into later December, or first part of next year. What do you got coming up?
I am strongly and powerfully inclined to run one on February 13th, which is the Saturday of President's Day weekend, day before Valentine's Day. So you guys will have to make it up with the wives to get that whole day. But I'd like to run one. It'll probably be a Civil War scenario. I'm very anxious to implement, put into practice a lot of the lessons that I learned from our last event. But again, it's going to take a lot of work and preparation on my part. So I haven't quite announced it yet, but I probably will soon. And I think February 13th is going to be it. And the way to join is probably to either reach out to me by email or to go to our Facebook page, where I'll post a lot of announcements and updates as things develop.
And so as somebody's looking to jump into that, it's an all-day thing, but it is only a one-day thing, correct?
Right. We're probably going to use Tabletop Simulator again in Discord, and we've kind of figured out a way to put everybody at their own little table with their own little map. So a lot is just going to depend on how many umpires I can get to commit to it, and then that'll sort of help to determine how big I can run this event, because I think I'll have as many participants as I let in. That's what ended up happening this last Saturday. We had tons of participants. I even had people showing up a day or two before. And I don't like to turn anyone away, so I'll try to at least give somebody something to command, even if it's a Johnny detail. I want people to play. And again, this is all part of my master plan. If I get enough people excited about Kriegsspiel and playing it, eventually they'll put on games. And finally, I will actually get a chance to play, which is why I'm so grateful to Jim, because thanks to him, I finally got a chance to play.
Gotcha. Yeah, absolutely. Scott, I think at this point, you're just playing in as many of these as you can pull off. I don't think you have any plans, or any of the folks down there in Cincinnati have any plans to set up one of these that somebody would be able to jump into play, right?
Oh, no. I'm the only person in Cincinnati that was involved in this one. And there's other people that you've seen at Origins that live near me. But Ted, who I'm sure I know has done some stuff with you, but he's very much more into Vietnam. Now, if you ever do a Vietnam one, I guarantee he will play.
Yeah, that seems like a a theater of war just made for something with limited fog of war. So
there was a I'll just put this out there, and I say I have all of Mark's notes. There's a wonderful gentleman who's actually joined us on some of our Saturday night fights from Great Britain, who runs a lot of Kriegspiels out of Britain. He runs one every Historicon, and he's got one based on City of Confusion. He ran a Kriegspiel, and I umpired for him. So I have those notes. They do exist.
I will say the one thing that I thought about following the Kriegspiel, especially before I got into the 1807 one, and honestly, I don't think I could handle more than one at a time. I'd get them mixed up in my head.
Yeah.
But the one thing I'd thought about, and I think it would be a similar experience, would be doing one like the diplomacy using Backstabber, where you don't know who you're talking to. You just know you're talking to the French. And obviously, it's not going to be the same fog of war situation, but I think it would be kind of that same feel where you've got that little bit of role playing where you're talking to people and sending orders to people, and you don't really know what's going to go on. I think that would be a similar experience in some ways, at least a tangentially similar experience, obviously not the same. But before I got in the 1807, I really thought about trying to find a group to do some online diplomacy with, just because I thought it would fill the gap.
Yes. One of the Kriegspiels, you know, you talk about retirement, what you want to do. One of the Kriegspiels I very much want to do before my life is over, I borrowed it from Mark again. Years ago, they ran a Kriegspiel that was entirely based on a group of German tribes trying to deal with a Roman camp during the Gallic Wars. And there was a boatload of intertribal diplomacy that was a critical part of it. And you know, the ability, you know, and it used a little bit of the Matrix stuff in terms of preset roles, i.e., you know that this guy from the Nervii was a jerk to your grandfather, so your family still bears a grudge even though you don't know him. And there was an expected level of role play there. There's Kriegspiel is so low intensity, so resource non-intensive. Yeah, it's time intensive, but it doesn't cost anything, really. And with the technology we have, it's the field is so broad and so open. It's such a terrific thing to do. People should do them.
Well, if you do them James, in person, I know you guys have... they get pretty expensive. Yeah. I will say that.
Maps
they're astronomical to print maps, but
I know you've got a nice. I think what of the five people on this call, three of us have very expensive copies of the Meckel map. So mine are printed. No, mine is printed at full size on PVC and mounted on PVC with laminate over it, so I can write on it. So. Yeah. And then if you're buying multiple block sets and all that stuff, heavens yes.
Custom heavens yes. block sets.
Yeah, you can do some big black and whites for not a ton of money, but obviously those aren't going to be quite as snazzy, right? That's definitely a challenge. James, I know you guys in the past have done some real life smaller conventions in the Kansas City area. Clearly those aren't happening at the moment. Again, given the plague that is upon the land, but are there any online games of the Kriegspiel-like variety coming up that your team is a part of or has in the imminent offing at all?
So the answer is sort of a maybe. Mike Dunn has been messing around with trying to make Roll20, which is built for role-playing games, work as a Kriegspiel driver. And we did some messing with it this summer and concluded, nope, doesn't work, threw it out the window. And then about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I forget exactly when, he attended some talk at a online game convention in which somebody did basically a tutorial on how to get more out of Roll20. And he came away with that saying, hey, there are these cool things that I think I can do. So let me get back to you and we'll see if they work. I'm still waiting, in part because we're pretty busy at the moment. But in a couple of weeks, the busy should tail off again. And that's one of the experiments I would like to get to, not least because if we can avoid a solution that involves people owning multiple computers or having to buy multiple iterations of software, that would be really a good thing. The tabletop simulator approach worked, but when you've got to have three computers to see three boards, that's kind of a showstopper for many of us, unfortunately.
Yeah,
so we'll see how that goes. We'll see if it works. And if it does seem to be working, then it's entirely possible that we will run a public test to sort of stress test the thing.
Listen, guys, this has been great fun. I know it's a bunch of, you know, sort of so there I was kind of war stories. But it is fun to find out sort of what happened with that Kriegsspiel afterwards when those of us on the outside are just seeing, you know, just seeing the clock march on through the forums as Jim is updating everybody on what the time is in the big situation. But the rest of us, you know, we've been interested in what's happening with the battle and now get to find out about it afterwards. And so it's nice to hear your perspectives as participants. You know, this is what happened. This is how it happened. This is what I saw. This is what I thought I saw. Those are always fun to find out. Because again, you guys are trying to make the best decisions you can with the information you have. And it's always, that's always the caveat, right? With the information you have. And that's what makes all this so enjoyable. So Scott, Marshall, thank you guys very much for joining us for first podcast with us here on Mentioned in Dispatches. We appreciate you showing up.
No problem at all. Anytime.
So thanks.
Thank you.
And James, thank you for coming back again. I think this might have been the first one you were on this season, but obviously no stranger to Mentioned in Dispatch. And Jim, I don't think we've done one under 90 minutes with you this season yet. So we're keeping our streak alive here. And we appreciate that. So audience, listen, this is the last episode of season 5 for Mentioned in Dispatches. We will be back after the holidays with season 6 as we charge on into a whole bunch of other different topics. But after this, we're going on hiatus for a couple of months. So you're not going to hear, not for a couple months, for a couple of weeks. So you're not going to hear from us again until 2021. So we hope all of your gaming goes as you hope over this holiday period, that whatever fabulous and wonderful games you get over the holidays as gifts or manage to give as gifts, that the people who would be offended by the amount of money you spend on them never find out how much they cost. Let us all hope for that Christmas wish for everyone. So, but yeah, especially the audience, thank you very much, because this doesn't happen without y'all. Otherwise, it's just us screaming into the void, which we are wont to do anyway, but we appreciate the audience joins us. So thank you very much. Guys, it's been great fun. Good night from here. And for the audience, good evening or good afternoon or good morning or whatever time you're listening to us. Thank you a lot. We'll see you next year.